Reading from Sri Gyanamata, one of Yogananda's most highly developed disciples. Just before I came to Mount Washington, I was listening one day to a program on the radio. My attention was caught by the following words: "I am but a simple maid, foolish and unheeding, yet I follow unafraid where my heart is leading." These were just the words of a song from a light opera, but I copied them down because I recognized that they described the path I had been following. From point to point, from one object of love to another, I had followed unafraid, until at last the twin stars of love and devotion led me to Paramahansaji, to Mount Washington, to God alone. God lures us from one object of desire to another, until we understand that it is He Himself that we have been longing for all the time. And in Him our restless hearts find rest. I brought with me the thirst for the infinite, and I have come for the meeting with Him. I have come to measure spiritual advancement not alone by light that surrounds one when he meditates, or by the visions he has of the saints, but by what he is able to endure in the hard, cold light of day. Jesus' transfiguration on the mount is not the only thing that is told of him. Just possibly, it is not the most important. It is said that for the joy which was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and for that reason is set down at the right hand of God. His greatness was not only that he could go into meditation and gloriously realize his oneness with the Father, his absolute identity, but also he could endure. I always remember this truth when I mentally try to find a way of escape from something that I think is too hard for me. I think then I am escaping, not overcoming. Happening to know that having to give up your room... Oh, excuse me. That was the end of that. So, finish that off again. He would not have helped me. Well, Ram's having fun with me. I always remember this truth when I'm trying to find my way to escape from something that seems too hard for me. I think then I'm escaping, not overcoming. From Yogananda's commentary on the scriptures, "Lo, I am with you always," from Discourse 75. All things are possible unto God and His great devotees. In the resurrection of Jesus, we have the assurance of our Creator that God-realized devotees, if they wish, can find not only immortality of soul, but also of the body. The whole drama of Jesus' life is a testament to the supremacy of man's spirit over matter. He had willingly incarnated in a human form, partaking of its inherent limitations, to show matter-bound souls the way to conquer every form of delusion imposed on them by the overreaching power of cosmic Satan. Jesus' resurrection demonstrated the consummation of that victory. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Resurrection means to rise again. What rises again and how? Though restoring life to a deceased body, as Jesus did for Lazarus, is indeed one form of resurrection, what Jesus evidenced after his crucifixion was much higher. It was the resurrection of the soul into oneness with spirit. The soul's ascension from delusory confinement of the body, consciousness, into its native immortality and everlasting freedom. Lazarus and others whose bodies were raised from the dead by Jesus gained new life, new opportunity for spiritual advancement. But Jesus' resurrection lifted his consciousness beyond all relativities of vibratory creation and merged himself into the transcendental Father, absolute spirit. After attaining oneness with the absolute, Jesus infused his spirit expanded soul back into his crucified body, immortalizing it, and returned for the benefit of his disciples in physical form. Jesus accomplished this ascension in definite steps after his crucifixion. To Mary Magdalene, who was the first disciple to see him on Easter morning, Jesus said, "Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren, and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father, and your Father, and to my God, and your God." It's very interesting to see the various roles of the name Mary plays in the New Testament. Mary, of course, is the mother of Jesus. And Mary is symbolic of a very deep meaning. Within every soul resides the masculine, the feminine, and that which transcends both. Through the Mary consciousness, which is the feeling nature within man, the soul is, in delusion, identified with this body. And through that delusion, it's kept in a state of bondage. But when that Mary, or that feeling nature, is purified, it ascends up into intuition. And at that point, you begin to really aspire for, to become one with the divine consciousness. Now, Mary, being the mother of Jesus, inwardly, means that intuitive perception that brings you to the feet of God and surrender to the infinite within yourself, is that Mary intuition. She knows, she has that purity of soul, and she has come to that point where she is the handmaiden of the Lord, or she is in that state of surrendered self from the human standpoint. And it is through that consciousness of being surrendered that the Christ can begin to manifest or is born into human consciousness. It comes from the star that is right within you when you meditate and you look at the point between the eyebrows, the ajna. You see there a wonderful, beautiful light. It is of a pearlescent type of light. It is white, but it is wonderful and it is warm, and it has great joy in it. And when you see it, you feel that joy. Now, the first time that I saw that star, I didn't feel the joy. I was meditating and thinking about God. And that light suddenly appeared as a beautifully formed five-pointed star, exactly as Master and Mother described. And it lasted for some 5 minutes or so. And I looked at it, and I was wonderfully inspired from it, but I didn't have the feeling nature that went with it. So it felt incomplete to me somehow. I wasn't satisfied with that experience alone, even though it was a great uplift for me at the time. I knew that there was more. There had to be more. Having a physical vision or a vision of an inner sort is not enough. Sometimes people say, well, if I just saw a miracle, then I would believe in God or I would believe in something higher. But is that true? Because when you see that there are miracles that are manifest in and around us, the mind gets busy right away. It tries to discount it. It tries to find physical reasons why that might happen, or it's an anomaly, and who can account for it, but I'm not going to infer anything greater because this has happened in my life. And so the mind becomes dulled to spiritual sensitivities. And through this dullness of mind, the sense of attachment to the body grows stronger and stronger. But when we come into that virginal Mary state, we sense the purity, we sense our longing for spiritual consciousness beyond all else. Until then, we are drawn back and forth on both sides. There may be a part of us who aspires for something spiritual, but we are very much drawn to the things of matter. We are drawn very much to material things, to money, to fame, to all the things that this world can bring to us, that we think will bring us lasting and true happiness. But who has it? When you acquire money, when you acquire fame, you also acquire a pack of troubles with it. If you look on the grocery stand, as you go to the checkout, you see all the people who have achieved some sense of fame. And you see everything printed about them. Some of it true, some of it made up. It makes no difference because it all sells. You can tell whether somebody's getting a flattering portrait in the article or something defamatory by the picture on the front. If they look terrible and it's the worst picture you can imagine of them, you know that they're going after them. And if they're all dressed up and beautiful and looking just right, then you know that it's going to be complimentary to them. And so it goes back and forth like this. Fame brings with it that two-edged sword, as well does wealth. Because with wealth comes responsibility, and the responsibility of what you do with it, and how you handle it. And then people get involved in how you keep it and how you make it grow more. And there's no end to it. We never get to that place where we feel completely satisfied with it. Because that kind of peace can only come from this inner ascension, from this inner awakening. And this is what Mary has come to that point. The feeling nature has been purified. Now, in Mary Magdalene's case, she is, it is said, to have had seven sins in her. And that means that all of her inner chakras, those places of consciousness within, those sub-power stations within the spine and the brain, are all deadened to divine consciousness. They have no life in them in a spiritual way. And the Christ came and awakened her, brought those out, healed her of that ignorance and of that darkness. And when that came, she became a foremost disciple of the Master. So she is there at the time after the crucifixion. She is there at the crucifixion, and she is the first one to arrive at the tomb. But the tomb is looking into the unconscious mind. It is looking for the dead body. The dead body represents the material manifestation of the Master. And so her vision is not yet completely purified. And then she summons Peter and she summons John to come and look in the tomb as well. And so they come, and then she is weeping by herself because the body is gone, you see. And this relates to everyone who is in grief because somebody leaves the body. And we feel that we have no more connection with them. We feel that they have left us. And therefore we grieve. We feel wounded by that. But it's not the truth, because no individual is their body. It's just simply a vehicle that they inhabit and that they have for a time, and then it is gone. It is only when we come into this resurrected consciousness that we realize that life transcends death. And this is our death of the body. And this is a great thing. Because when you come into that realization, all fear leaves you. What in the world are you to be afraid of then? When you know through and through that you are not this body, you have a body, but you are not the body. You have thoughts, but you are not those thoughts. You have feelings, but you are not those feelings. You are the eternal, ever-present, all-pervading spirit. And that is the truth of your being. That is the resurrection of the Christ within you when you come to know that absolutely and completely. Now, people have experiences in this and they have their beliefs about it. But it's another thing to come into the complete and absolute realization of it, to where all the way through you, you know this to be true. It's founded upon a rock and not upon the shifting sands of mind, of belief, of supposition, or of an occasional experience that has awakened that in you. This is a great, great difference. So Mary discovers Jesus, but he says, "Touch me not." And why? Why did he tell Mary not to touch him? What did he mean when he said, "I have not yet ascended to my Father"? There is deep significance here. Jesus had prophesied that he would rise again after 3 days, or on the third day after his crucifixion. "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will rise it up." He spake of the temple of his body. 3 days means 3 periods. Jesus was not emphasizing in a literal sense the 24 hours in each day, but 3 phases of expression required to liberate his soul from the physical to the astral and then to the spiritual or causal plane, and from there to complete emergence in the cosmic consciousness of the Father. So I'll read that again. Jesus was emphasizing the 3 phases of expression required to liberate his soul from the physical to the astral and then to the spiritual or causal plane, from which there is complete emergence in cosmic consciousness. Now the physical, we all know about this, is this physical body that we live in. It's such a pesky reminder much of the time. It gives us coughs, it gives us illness, it gives us various difficulties. And so it reminds us that it's there. It also tempts us with pleasures and wants us to enjoy that garden of pleasures to the exclusion of everything else. And so this is the province of the body. Everything that we receive through the 5 senses is in the province of the body. The ego is the individuality that is built up around the body consciousness. And so it comes as a means of interfacing with this worldly life. And through this, we are able to function in this world, but we are limited when we are in the physical consciousness only, because deeply embedded within this physical consciousness, in fact, precedent to it, is this astral force. The astral is the electrical life energy body within you. It is the light body. It is the body that you inhabit when you have dreams. It is the body that you ordinarily inhabit when you leave this body in physical death and you ascend up into your astral body. And you have a life there. Many of us have difficulty adjusting to this life on earth because we are so filled with memories and the sense sensations of what it was like to be in the astral worlds, which is much more refined, much freer, much more attuned. Our environment is much more attuned to who we are. And so when we get into this physical realm, it can be a very difficult adjustment. Beyond that is even the more subtle realm of the causal. That is the pure idea realm. And here you rise up and you are even in a more expanded level of consciousness. You are free of the energy body and of light form. You are now more closely attuned to the original divine spirit from which you have evolved. And for those who move from the third body or the causal body into that pure expression of spirit without form that is beginningless and endless, beyond the comprehension of most people. And it is here that we find as the origin of all life, all consciousness, all intelligence, all love, all light, everything that we love and hold dear about the highest virtues and aspects of life have all come from this. Now, anything of a negative sort has evolved out of this, but it is because of the limitations that we have imposed upon creative spirit. When we rise into that all-pervasive consciousness, and then look out upon this creation, we see nothing but light. We see nothing but spirit. This is why the great saints and great sages say the world is God. Everything is God. But to our eyes, we look out and we see pain, we see difficulties, we see wars, we see transgressions of one against another. And as a result of that, we feel very discouraged about this life. But it shouldn't be so, not in an absolute sense. Certainly our compassion goes out to those who are suffering, those who do not have enough, those who are abused and hurt and killed. Our hearts go out to them completely. But there is also this additional vision in which we see that everything has come from this original, pure spirit, and it manifests and pervades everything that has been created. When you have entered into this consciousness and your mind has become completely purified, you open your 2 eyes of the body if you return back into physical consciousness. Not everyone does. And when they do, they look out and they see now that divine consciousness is absolute manifest in everything that they see. Now, in this story, Jesus, the Son of Man, that is ascending into being the Son of God, or that pure expression of Spirit, has not yet had that complete purification. So inwardly, we would say that Mary don't touch me yet, because there's a danger. When you're lifted up into the higher spiritual realms, you have that possibility of still having your consciousness drawn back down into the body. Jesus warned of false prophets. And these false prophets come through an assumed idea. And we see this manifest in many great spiritual masters and leaders who have not yet come to that full realization. They are drawn back down into body consciousness and temptation once again. But because the Christ, Jesus, the Son of Man, has such purity of mind, he knows not to enter into that feeling nature, not yet. There comes a time, as Mother described, when you go over the top. And at that point, you are no longer tempted to be drawn back down into sense consciousness. But as long as you are dwelling in this body, and there's anything of any seeds of memories left within the 10 qualities of the mind, then you are in danger still. And so it is only through overcoming and lifting your consciousness all the way to the top, all the way over the top. Papa warned about this as well, that you need to be very careful and not play fast and loose with these things, because they can trip you up and take you down. So he says, do not touch me. Now, many incarnations are required for an unevolved soul to accomplish this, because Jesus knew the process of descent into flesh that had been required for an incarnation on earth of his previously liberated soul. He came as an avatar. He was already liberated before he came into this world, but he came in for our sakes. And with this knowledge and power, he needed simply to employ the creative principles that would reverse that process. Thus, he would quickly be able to free his soul from the physical, astral, and causal limitations by 3 distinct efforts, and would be able to reunite with its omniscience and omnipotence of the Spirit. When the consciousness experiences oneness with the infinite consciousness of God in a state of deep samadhi, while the soul yet retains its residence in the physical body, or in the astral form encasing the causal body after death, the transcendent ecstatic consciousness will inevitably return to the bodily habitation, the physical or astral, as the case may be. Similarly, when Jesus entered Mahasamadhi, a God-realized soul conscious ascension from the physical body at the time of death, he merged his consciousness into the blissful presence of cosmic consciousness of God the Father, and thence returned to his yet-to-be-relinquished heavenly-garbed astral form. Therein, in Christ's ecstasy, he began expeditiously to unloose, with the supreme soul science of liberation, the knots of life and consciousness that both enabled and resulted from his earthly incarnation. In other words, when you're released from this physical form, all of your attachments to it, now you're residing mostly in the astral form. In Mother's case, it resulted in her heart shifting from the left side to the right side, not physically, but there is a transfer of consciousness. And she felt that transfer come through the baptism of blood. She felt the gurgling of blood moving from her left side to her right side. And in the Bible it says that a fool's man, his heart is on the left side, a wise man on the right side. And by this, it means that you have released your consciousness from the physical and are now in the astral, more closely attuned with divine consciousness. This is the second stage, and has with it its own experiences that go with it. These are stages and not to be confused with days in a 24-hour day. It doesn't happen that way. These things can go over many years, even over many lifetimes. Expressed succinctly, human nature is an interaction of three gunas, or essential creative and motivating qualities of cosmic nature, identified with the scriptures of India as sattva, tamas, and rajas. The good or elevating mode, that is the sattva, the evil or grossening mode, that is the tamas, the activating mode, which is the rajas. The seed of one's past actions, actions that were stimulated by the good, bad, and activating qualities, remain subtly lodged in the astral and causal bodies of the physically dead individual. As the Bhagavad Gita states, all action is universally engendered by the attributes or gunas of the primordial nature or prakriti, diluted by the attributes of primordial nature. The ignorant must cling to the activities engendered by these three gunas. Overcoming the sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic karma, invading the three bodies of man is required for any incarnate soul to disengage from man's delusive domain and return to oneness with the eternal bliss of spirit. The gunas inherent in the prakriti, sattva, rajas, and tamas, imprison the body, the imperishable dweller. Having transcended the three modes of nature, the cause of physical embodiment, a man is released from the sufferings of birth, old age, death, and attains immortality. Now this is quite a promise. A man is released from sufferings of birth, old age, and death. He attains immortality. When Jesus first appeared to Mary Magdalene, he had raised his body from the tomb, yet he said, "Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father." That is, his soul had not finished working out all the untangling interactions of the three gunas imprinted on his astral and causal bodies, so that he could leave their limitations in oneness with spirit. That accomplished, he would have the freedom and omnipotence of spirit to remain merged in infinite consciousness, or to assume his immortalized familiar form, tangible to the mortal senses, but unsubject to the incarnate circumscriptions. So when you enter into this infinite divine consciousness, you are now freed. There are no more cords that hold you bound to this physical body. Now, as Mother explained, in order to inhabit a physical body, you have to have a certain amount of ignorance. That's just how it is. If you are always in the cosmic consciousness, supreme beyond all else, you wouldn't be able to focus your mind on this one physical form. You would be transcendent and feeling yourself a part of all forms. And so in order to take a particularized focal point of consciousness, you have to reduce, so to speak. The difference here is that from a fall of when the consciousness becomes totally identified with the physical body, you do not ever lose your connection with divine consciousness. Now you are conscious that you are playing a role within the world stage. You are always aware of your connection with the infinite divine consciousness. And at will, you may just merge yourself into that infinite divine consciousness. Now, there are many different stages to this. And the most subtle is the causal. I remember once when I was walking down a path out in the woods, and suddenly my consciousness was transferred to the causal. And I was aware not of the physical body, not of astral or energetic body, but I was aware of everything as a idea. The path I was walking upon, the body that I inhabited, the trees, the shrubs, everything, the sunlight, were all ideas hanging upon the one omnipotent force of divine spirit emanating from that. And it was beautiful. It was subtle beyond description. I wish that I could convey in some descriptive manner how wonderful and how beautiful, how freeing it is to be in that wonderful causal spirit. Beyond that causal spirit, there is the release into the infinite kingdom of consciousness. Now this is the highest, it is the pinnacle of human experience. Now there are many different elements to this physical creation. There are many different elements to astral and causal creation. But here is the greatest miracle of all. Right within you, right within your own heart, right within your own soul, right within your own consciousness, resides your link with that infinite consciousness. No matter how much we search the heavens and earth for divine consciousness in an outer form, it will never satisfy us. It will never bring us into that absolute realization of your oneness with that divine consciousness. And you don't have to wait for this world to catch up. In fact, this world has benefited. When you dive deep into that divine consciousness. Now it is our habit nature to be associated with this body and ego consciousness. And it's not an easy thing to chip away at. It's not an easy thing to clear ourselves of. But the truth is that you are, even in this moment, whether you realize it or not, that infinite divine consciousness. And if you could but know it, if you could but cast aside all delusions, everything that has kept you captive from when your separate incarnation started until now, set it all aside and proclaim your freedom in spirit, you would have it even now. Even now. And then to hold that connection and never let it go, never let it go, never let anything of this outer world proclaim its stamp upon you in a way that would make you servitude toward it. This is what this day is really commemorating. It's not a man 2,000 years ago who went through these experiences. Certainly, there's a great, great soul that infused a tremendous light into this world. And through these stories are told the story of every man evolving from the human into the divine. It is your story. It is my story. It is the story of everyone who walks upon this earth. And when we are called, and if you are not called, you would not be here. When you are called, you have that potential. So do not get wrapped up in those things that keep you in any lower realm. It's not easy. It's not easy because it goes against all of our fears. It goes against all of our thoughts of limitations. But the truth is that you are one even now with that divine spirit, if you could but realize it. By the power of his Christ wisdom and sattvic karma accrued through his free will, governed righteous actions on earth, Jesus burned all the last traces of karmic residue left by his flesh engendered fear of death when he said, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine will be done. And when on the cross he cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The delusion of his painful mortal death was so persuasive for that for a moment Jesus lost touch with the reality that an omnipotent God, his own divine Father, could never forsake him. Delusion imposed metaphysical weakness, no matter how tenuous, how to be expunged before complete liberation of spirit is attained, even by the superlative incarnate souls as Jesus. So we have the example here. Jesus said, come, see, to his disciples. That was the first thing. Come and see. Come and check this out. Come and see what this life is all about. Observe me, close up, firsthand. Walk with me. See what I teach. See if it isn't something that appeals to you. And then, as he progressed along with the disciples, or rather they progressed along with him. He is the spiritual teacher. He began to lay out for them, if you would be my disciples, then you must follow me. Then you must do as I do. You must love as I love. You must live as I live. And yet they weren't there yet, because he said, where I go, you cannot come. They had not yet ascended into that realm of consciousness. And then, as he got closer to the goal, he gave them an intimate sign. He said, here, drink, this is my blood, this is my flesh. Now that sounds like a gruesome thing to say, doesn't it? He wasn't talking about cannibalism. What he was talking about was, he's saying, merge your life into my life. Let your blood become my blood, and vice versa. Let your flesh become my flesh. Let it become so intertwined that there is no difference between the two. This is the third step of discipleship. And so first we come and we see. We find out whether this is the truth or not, to our liking at first. And then we begin to take the steps towards that discipleship. And finally, we merge our spirit into the spirit of the Master and into divine spirit. And when we do that, we transcend and go beyond all the limitations. And we find out what the truth really is, not because somebody taught us, not because we read it in a book somewhere, but because we've experienced it deep within our soul, and to such a degree that it's completely transformed our life. Our life is now not our own, but we are now infused with the divine spirit that is all bliss, all joy, all light, all purity, everything good. And you are that, and that is you, and that is resurrection, the resurrection of your soul into the pure and unalloyed spirit of divine consciousness. This is an invitation to one and all. Come, come and see. Come and follow me and do as I do. Come and merge yourself into my consciousness, into my spirit, and I and my Father are one. I, the pure Christ consciousness, is also the divine Father beyond all consciousness. And you will realize what I have realized. You will know what I know. You will experience as I experience. And there will be no difference. This is the sum cum laude of your life. And if you would take it and accept it, it will change your life never to be again, and you will never look back and regret one bit of effort you ever made in attaining that divine consciousness. Be it so. Be it so for you and for all. That you may not have that realization, not just for yourself, but for all mankind. For when you are lifted up, you lift up all mankind with you. And this is the great secret, that if we really want to see this world changed and healed, then we will change ourselves. And as Master used to say, change yourself and you will change thousands. I have an announcement. Some of you will know this individual and others won't, but I'll read the announcement first and then I'll say a few things about it. This came from Kusani, India, March 24, 2009. Reverend David Hickenbottom. A few lines of bad news. Rob Ivey died while undergoing treatment for cancer in one of the cancer hospitals in Haldwani. Rob died on the 18th or 19th of February in a hotel room. The police took the body and did all the autopsy inquiry in the hospital in Haldwani. In his will, he prepared in October of 2008, he requested that I cremate his body as per Hindu custom. The body was brought by police from Haldwani to his residence in Kusani in the early hours of 22nd February. After a couple hours, we took the body to Bageshwar, where we solemnly consigned his mortal remains to the flame. In our area, Bageshwar is one of the holy, is a holy place. It's considered the second Banaras in India. In our area, Bageshwar is a holy place established at the confluence of two rivers. It is 40 kilometers from Kushani. Rest on hearing from your kindness. Sincerely, A.S. Nagy. Mr. Nagy was a good friend and landlord to Rob. I put some pictures out here of Rob. And I first met Rob with Mother and many years ago, and we didn't know each other well then. But when I was at Anandashram in 2003, I met Rob there then. And we had many good conversations. He had just received an inheritance from his father, and he thought, well, I could either buy a home here in Texas, where he's living at the time, or I could retire in India and go there to the Himalayas to meditate. So he was at the ashram, and he had just made that decision, and he was going to go north and live up in the Himalayas there. So later I heard from Rob and received a letter, and he asked whether I could bring lessons for him or not. Well, Master's Lessons comes in 7 volumes and probably weigh a good 20 pounds or so, but I said yes, and we traveled all over India and up into the mountains with these lessons, as well as all the other things we brought for him. And he had a lovely situation in Kusani. It sits on a hillside and has a 120-degree view of snow-capped Himalayas, Nandi Devi, which is about 26,000 feet in altitude, is right there in front of you, and all these other snow-capped peaks all around you. And he took us to a special place where he used to meditate on the side of the hill where you could see all of this. He had a wonderful house. He had one end of the house, and he had been fixing it up. He wanted everything perfect, but he said, you know, here up in the Himalayas, there's no Home Depot down the street. And he had to go to Almora, which is a day's journey away, to get any kind of tools or anything, many of them inferior to anything. He showed me his fingers, which were all bruised and cut from working on his place there to make it perfect. He was a perfectionist, and he wanted it just so. He had set up a beautiful altar. Well, in 2003, when we had been at the ashram, he had gone through many years of wondering. He had several different teachers down through the years. Mother was the first, and he felt somewhat conflicted because he had some wonderful Buddhist teachers and others that he felt a great reverence for, and he didn't know whether Mother was his Satguru. And so we talked about it. And somehow, through our conversation, he came to the realization, after many years of struggle, that Mother was his Satguru, that she was the one who came to bring him all the way into God consciousness. And so it made a great deal of difference to him, and we had a wonderful visit with him in Kusani. We spent several days there, and it was a beautiful, lovely place. And so he fulfilled his dream of what he really wanted to do. I was shocked and I was saddened when I received the news. But I know that he lived the last years exactly as he wanted to. He was a lively person. He had a lot of life energy. He had a wonderful sense of humor. And he is a lovely, lovely soul and a very sincere aspirant. He was really meditating deeply in order to realize that highest development in consciousness that we've been speaking here today. And I know that Mother was there when he left the body and received him into the higher realms. And so I wanted to say a few words about him, because if you know him, then you have your own memories of him. But if you didn't, maybe gives you a little feeling for the man. And what a wonderful, deeply spiritual soul he was. Let this serve as a reminder to all of us that our life here is limited. It's not that we should be sad or morose, but we should be mindful. There comes a time when we leave this body, and we don't know how soon or how far, so we can't just assume that it's some way, way out into the future. That we need to live our life in such a way that if we were taken at any particular moment, we could stand back and say, this is a life well lived. And of course, the highest and the greatest aspiration that we can have as human beings is to ascend into the highest divine consciousness, to so purify body, mind, and soul that we would achieve that oneness.